Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Kevin Gastola, managing editor of the investigative news website Shadowproof.com, who examines the Trump administration's unprecedented use of the 1917 Espionage Act in prosecuting Julian Assange and the threat it poses to press freedom. Paul Pilar of Georgetown University's Center for Security Studies and a former CIA analyst, who explains why President Trump's military threats against Iran strengthens Tehran's hardliners and weakens moderates. And Matoi Monroe of United American Indians of New England, who talks about a bill she's supporting that would replace Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day statewide across Massachusetts. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
China's leader, President Xi Jinping, may have a winning hand in confronting President Trump's escalating trade war with China. Xi made a recent well-publicized visit to a facility that processes rare earth minerals, with an implicit threat that he could cut off the U.S. supply of these materials, which are vital to the global digital economy. Chinese-made permanent magnets, which incorporate four different rare earth elements to differing degrees, are used in various products, including earbuds, wind turbines, and electric cars, and China dominates their production. In 2010, Beijing used their dominance in rare earth materials as leverage in negotiations with Japan over disputed islands in the East China Sea. Foreign Policy magazine reports that China won a short-term advantage, but that the embargo drove other countries to reassess and reduce their reliance on critical materials that Beijing controls. Meanwhile, the Trump administration placed China's giant telecom company, Huawei, the world's largest developer of 5G mobile technology, on a Commerce Department list of companies seen as a national security risk, thus preventing it from leasing or buying U.S. technology. Full implementation of the ban was delayed for 90 days. Quickly, Google, Intel, and Qualcomm dropped contracts with Huawei. But the U.S. moves, meant to punish China, could accelerate the very Chinese policies the Trump administration has sought to derail. Hu Shijin, editor of the Chinese government-owned Global Times newspaper, says Huawei has for many years had a backup plan to prepare for a cutoff of Western technology by increasing domestic semiconductor and high-tech manufacturing. These policies, in fact, could hasten the erosion of U.S. dominance in the global chip market. In villages east of Cape Town, South Africa, the stark racist divide of the apartheid era is clearly visible today. On the white side of the village of McGregor, for instance, stately Georgian homes with a car in every driveway are common. In black and mixed-race neighborhoods, laborers live in thatched cottages and pick fruit to survive. The legacy of apartheid can be traced back to Cecil Rhodes, prime minister of what was then known as Britain's Cape Colony, who in 1894 restricted black Africans to segregated areas of the Cape. The 1913 Native Lands Act limited blacks to 13% of arable land. During the height of apartheid, non-whites were pushed out of white-dominated towns into isolated regions known as Bantustans. The Africans' land was sold to white farmers without compensation. Land reform is a key unkept promise of the African National Congress, the party which has governed South Africa for the past 25 years. Now pressure is building for property expropriation without compensation from white owners who control 72% of the land, raising fears among right-wing whites of Zimbabwe-style land seizures. A new political party, the Economic Freedom Fighters, the third largest party in parliament with 6% of the vote, is demanding that all South African land, as well as all banks and mineral rights, be nationalized to rectify economic inequality. President Cyril Ramaphosa, elected in 2018, has appointed an advisory panel to determine how to proceed on the hotly debated land reform issue. In early April, the Chicago chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America, or DSA, celebrated as 6 of their members were elected to the city council. Now the DSA chapter is working to ensure that their new council members follow through on their pledge to address issues, including removing lead from local drinking water sources and shutting down the Chicago Police Department's gang database. Across the U.S., DSA's membership has grown nearly tenfold since Donald Trump was elected president in 2016. 60 DSA-endorsed candidates have won recent elections, from local school boards to Congress, where Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York City famously won a seat in the House of Representatives. DSA activist Kara Glow won a school board seat in Moorhead, Minnesota, over a dozen other candidates. While Glow is too busy these days to go to chapter meetings, she does find time to stay in touch with DSA activists. Thus far, accountability between DSA chapters and the politicians they endorse and campaign for has been based on goodwill and the glue of personal relationships. But now chapters are beginning to explore more formalized structures and working more closely in coalition with other progressive groups. As one member told In These Times magazine, "It's not just about getting people elected. It's about building the movement." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruth Ann Baumgartner.
WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange was arrested inside Ecuador's London embassy on April 11th after the South American nation's president, Lenin Moreno, withdrew asylum protection. Assange had taken refuge in the diplomatic compound in 2012 to avoid extradition to Sweden over a sexual assault case. Assange now faces extradition to the U.S. after the Trump Justice Department unsealed a 17-count indictment against Assange for violating the Espionage Act, for his publication of classified military and diplomatic documents in 2010, in addition to one earlier charge of conspiracy to commit computer intrusion. Assange worked with former U.S. Army intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning, who had leaked hundreds of thousands of State Department cables and military files that exposed incidents involving American military misconduct in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Journalists and media outlets across the country have raised the alarm that invoking the Espionage Act is a direct attack on the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which, if upheld by the courts, would criminalize journalists who engage in investigative reporting on national security issues. Your reporter spoke with Kevin Gostola, managing editor of Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure, who examines the Trump administration's unprecedented use of the 1917 Espionage Act and the threat it poses to freedom of the press.
It's important to recognize that the Obama administration did not charge Julian Assange or anybody else affiliated or associated with WikiLeaks. Back in around 2013, they recognized that they had something called a New York Times problem. If they prosecuted Julian Assange, then whatever they used against him could be used to prosecute an editor or a journalist working for the New York Times, including on this material, because they published WikiLeaks materials that Chelsea Manning disclosed. And so they backed away. But the Donald Trump administration has decided that they would like to make Julian Assange a test case for cracking down on leaks. I believe they see Julian Assange as an easy target, because there is so much animosity and hostility toward him as a personality. So they believe that they can use that to their advantage to extradite, bring him to the United States, put him on trial, and use him as a kind of test case to set some confines and also discourage journalists from publishing certain classified information that, especially if you're talking about Republicans, they believe that should not be published. Now, there's a bit of bipartisanship when it comes to cracking down on leaks among Democrats and Republicans, but certainly one would agree that Democrats are less willing to buy into this idea that there should be what you call prior restraint, meaning that you could tell a publication not to publish certain information about national security matters. On the other hand, you have quite a loathing among Republicans. And they actually were the worst when it came to the WikiLeaks disclosures back in 2010, with people who are Republican even going so far to say that Julian Assange needed to be assassinated. In my opinion, this case is a test run to try to impose some constraints on freedom of the press.
Kevin, if the courts uphold these 17 counts or any number of counts leveled at Julian Assange under the Espionage Act, what would be the impact on journalists and news outlets everywhere across this country?
Well, in my opinion, it would really discourage people from engaging in what you call national security journalism. For example, everyone might remember the Edward Snowden documents that were published from the NSA. I think if you were Glenn Greenwald or Laura Poitras and you were involved in publishing those documents, you would be putting yourself at great risk because the government could then turn around and say, we have this case where we prosecuted Julian Assange, and not only do we want to prosecute the leaker, we want to go after the journalists because they should have known not to publish classified intelligence. It's important to recognize that what they're doing in their indictment is they're arguing that Julian Assange solicited this material from Chelsea Manning and that was how they managed to get this and then publish it. And they're actually targeting Julian Assange for publication, and they're describing a very standard journalistic interaction that goes on between a source and a publisher. It happens all the time that people talk to each other and the publisher finds out that the source has access to information. Then they build a relationship, they build rapport, they build trust, and then they go forward and they get that source to provide documentation for whatever they're going to expose that's in the public interest.
The British courts will now decide whether Julian Assange is extradited to the United States to face these charges. There's also another set of charges from Sweden, I believe, that are pending in British courts. But tell us about the decision that the British courts will have to make about extradition now that these 17 counts under the Espionage Act have been leveled at Julian Assange.
Essentially, what I know from following this case and also following his asylum request, which was granted by Ecuador, is that he's going to probably be arguing that he is charged with a political offense and that this Espionage Act thing is a crime that carries substantial amount of time in prison. If you send me to the United States, I could be cruelly mishandled because there are supermax prisons where people get put away for 22 hours out of 24 hours of the day. And I expect that in the UK, and then if he pursues his appeals through the wider European courts, that they'll listen to the sort of humanitarian arguments that will be made. They'll make a case that the Espionage Act is being pursued politically. They'll make a case involving freedom of expression and these freedom of press issues, which that'll be available in order to try and convince a judge to deny extradition.
That was Kevin Gostala, managing editor of Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. Find more analysis and commentary on the threat posed by the Trump administration's use of the Espionage Act to freedom of the press by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Weeks of increasing tensions between President Trump and Iran, that began with claims that the Islamic Republic was planning attacks on U.S. forces or allies, was further aggravated by Washington's deployment of an American aircraft carrier group, B-52 bombers, and 1,500 American soldiers to the Middle East region. This was followed by Trump declaring a national emergency over worsening relations with Iran, allowing him to bypass Congress to sell $8 billion worth of weapons to Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Jordan. On the president's recent visit to Japan, Mr. Trump indicated he was open to talks with Iranian leaders, prompting Prime Minister Shinzo Abe to offer to act as a mediator. But Iranian leaders were likely to see Trump's softer rhetoric as insincere after his administration's imposition of aggressive U.S. economic sanctions and a military buildup in the region. Your reporter spoke with Paul Pilar, non-resident senior fellow at Georgetown University's Center for Security Studies, who served in several senior positions with the CIA and the National Intelligence Council. Here he explains why President Trump's increased sanctions and military threats against Iran have strengthened hardliners and weakened moderates in Tehran's government.
It's quite clear that we got into this situation of tension and of war scare because of the Trump administration's policies, which is not to say that Iran today is not part of this tense dynamic. It certainly is, and they're doing their own things, but rather in the sense that we got into this situation of tension and perceived crisis because of the direction of the Trump administration policy. You know, before all this started, the Iranian regime was still abiding, rather scrupulously in fact, to its obligations under that nuclear accord, as was repeatedly certified by the inspections of the international inspectors in the IAEA. And what we see now with the Iranians just over the last month, you know, making some statements about, well, they probably will start exceeding the limits that were placed on them under that agreement. That is all a direct response to what the Trump administration has done. Now, we sometimes lose sight of how reactive it is and how much it's a response because this delay of a year. The Iranians are clearly trying to outweigh Trump. They have their hopes placed on regime change in Washington come January 2021. They are committed to this nuclear agreement. They are committed to trying to build on that to address other issues, and so they don't want to junk it. But we've had a whole year go by in which they're basically getting nothing of what they thought they were bargaining for. And in fact, you've got an administration that has gone well beyond that in trying to wreck the Iranian economy, not to mention all the military saber rattling.
Paul Pilar, one of the results of the Trump administration's maximum pressure campaign is that hardliners in Tehran have been strengthened while moderates have been weakened. What's the danger of that ahead as things ratchet up?
Well, it's already happening, and clearly the political position of those who were most involved in negotiating the nuclear agreement, that is to say, President Rouhani and Foreign Minister Zarif, has been significantly weakened. And we see that reflected somewhat in some of Rouhani's own rhetoric. You know, he's had to sound more hardline because he has to as a matter of political survival. And you also see it in statements from the Supreme Leader, Khamenei. He took a position all along as this agreement was being negotiated in which he basically told Rouhani, well, go to it, try to negotiate something, but I want to make it clear to the Iranian public and everyone else that this isn't my project. Basically, don't blame me if it goes wrong. Well, now he's saying, you know, I told you so. You couldn't trust those perfidious Americans. You know, I wasn't out front on this one to begin with. None of that's good from the standpoint of U.S. interests. I think the dynamic that we have here, and it's been the dynamic for some time, but we're really seeing it in spades over the last couple of years, the best friend that the hardliners in Tehran have is hardliners in Washington and vice versa. They play against each other, and each one does things that makes the hardliners on the other side have self-fulfilling prophecies. To be more specific, Scott, about looking ahead in the future, I would worry that those in the hardline camp in Iran would start thinking seriously and would start winning the arguments on this about making a nuclear weapon. You know, we do know, and this is all part of the past history that went into the need to negotiate this nuclear agreement, that in the past the Iranians had worked on a bomb. That work stopped almost 15 years ago. But when you have all these threats of application of military force and we're going to change your regime, everything that's coming out of Washington today, that strengthens the argument of those in Tehran who say, yes, we need a nuclear weapon. And in making that argument, they will be very quick to point to other examples. They'll say, well, look what happened to Saddam Hussein, who didn't have a nuke. Look what happened to Gaddafi, who gave up his unconventional weapons programs, and he didn't have a nuke. But look what Kim Jong-un is in North Korea is enjoying now. He's got this relationship with Trump. Trump is treating him with respect and kid gloves. And the big difference is Kim does have a nuke. You know, if you were in regime circles in Tehran, it'd be pretty hard to argue against that line of argument.
That was Paul Pilar, non-resident senior fellow at Georgetown University's Center for Security Studies, who served in several senior positions with the CIA and the National Intelligence Council. His most recent book is titled, Why America Misunderstands the World: National Experience and Roots of Misperception. Find more analysis on the dangers of the Trump administration's policy toward Iran by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Commonwealth of Massachusetts has a longer association with the indigenous inhabitants of what is now the United States than almost any other state. This year, a group calling itself Indigenous Peoples Day Massachusetts is supporting a bill in the state legislature that would replace Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day statewide. Supporters of the measure say the effort is twofold: to no longer observe Columbus Day, since it honors a man who exploited, tortured, killed, and ultimately committed genocide against all the native peoples he came in contact with, and secondly, to replace it with the commemoration of this country's first inhabitants, who have mostly been erased in the modern mind, but who still live on throughout the country. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Matui Monroe, who is co-leader of United American Indians of New England, which sponsors the annual Day of Mourning at Plymouth Rock, Massachusetts, and lead organizer with Indigenous Peoples Day. Here she talks about the campaign and explains why introducing Indigenous Peoples Day while continuing to observe Columbus Day is not a viable option.
We've been working on Indigenous Peoples Day campaigns here in Massachusetts since 2015, and here's why we're doing it. There's actually two parts of it. One is we need to get rid of Columbus Day entirely. Nobody should be celebrating Columbus. Children shouldn't be taught that Columbus discovered America. Children should not be taught that Columbus was a hero. And so when we go in and speak to communities, we start with talking about Columbus. And the historical truth is that he and his men invaded the Americas. They didn't discover anybody because people were already on their islands. He didn't bring civilization because people already had civilizations. He did bring Catholicism, and people were forced to convert to Catholicism over time. The actions of Columbus and his men were barbaric even for the 1400s. Largely, a lot of people didn't question this idea of the so-called discovery of America by Columbus. And a lot of people were not aware of how horrific his actions were. So, you know, we can understand in that context that people may not have understood then. But to be honest, people have known for quite a long time in more recent times. There was a lot of education done in 1992, around that time, for instance, which was the time of the 500th anniversary of Columbus's sailing. And that information has been out for quite a long time now. So when somebody comes in and defends Columbus and says that he should continue to be celebrated, that's really problematic. And it says that they're not listening, and it's a pretext for ongoing racism and invisibilization of Indigenous peoples, to be honest. That's part one. And part two of it is this. What we've been seeking to do, and this has been the case with Indigenous people since the 1970s, is to replace Columbus Day with something that's actually positive, which is Indigenous Peoples Day. Indigenous Peoples Day is now being celebrated instead of Columbus Day all over the country. For instance, very recently, the entire states of Maine and Vermont both passed legislation to replace Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day. We have a bill currently before the Massachusetts legislature to do that in Massachusetts. There are also many, many cities and towns that have done it. Los Angeles, San Francisco, Portland, Oregon, Albuquerque, we always say that Indigenous Peoples Day is something positive to replace something really damaging and negative, that is Columbus Day. And it explicitly replaces it. Really, it doesn't make sense to celebrate them side by side. I don't think any sensible person would say that you should celebrate Hitler's birthday at the same time that you celebrate Holocaust Remembrance Day. But in effect, that's what is happening when some people are saying that, oh, yeah, we can just continue to have Columbus Day and Indigenous Peoples Day on the same day. When we have Indigenous Peoples Day, it gives us an opportunity not only to talk about the history of some of these things, but it also gives us an opportunity to come in and talk about Indigenous human beings and tribal nations who continue to live in all of these areas, in every town, in every city, in every state, and talk about our ongoing resilience and survival, and to talk about our cultures, and to talk about the true history that we've experienced. These are things that a lot of non-Native people are not even particularly aware of. I read somewhere there was a study done that said that about 40% of non-Native people said they had never even met a Native person, for instance. And if you look in the media, if you look in statistics, if you look in newspapers or nearly everything else, Indigenous people are really erased in this country. You very rarely hear about us. So it gives us a chance to come forward and celebrate the original inhabitants of these lands. It also gives us a chance to talk about whose land this is, because there were obviously people here first, and a lot of non-Native people have never thought about who was here before the Europeans began invading.
That was Matui Monroe of United American Indians of New England and lead organizer with Indigenous Peoples Day Massachusetts. Learn more about the campaign in Massachusetts to replace Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WUML in Lowell, Massachusetts, WLSL in St. Leo, Florida, Palo Res Radio in Palo, California, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Ruth Ann Baumgartner, Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.